Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 369 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host, once again. Today, my guest is Shelby Bothan. And this is really kind of interesting because we don't normally spend that much time talking about the substantive aspects of law. But Shelby is a lawyer in North Dakota who focuses on estate planning in the agricultural community, and it owes to her roots as a agricultural insurance agent and the fact that her family has been in agricultural business for a couple of generations now. And what I find fascinating is to learn how much I didn't know, frankly, about the agricultural business on a large scale in the Midwest. You know, we have this romanticized version of what a farmer, or what it means to be a farmer. And really, I should think more along the lines of a big corporate business owner, because that's what farmers are. And so this is, to me personally, a fascinating conversation, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. So without any further delay, here is Shelby Bothan. Shelby Bothan, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you, Neil.
Well, I'm delighted to have you here with us today. Shelby, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. So my story probably goes back to high school, and I hate to go back that far, but we'll start there. I grew up in a small agricultural community in a place called Kindred, North Dakota. I graduated with a class of 55 people. And a unique thing about...
Wow. I think I had more than 55 people in my social studies class.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, so...
Really interesting.
Yeah, and it was one of our biggest classes at that time. I think now the classes are a little bit bigger, but yeah. So, and one of the classes that we could take in high school was this agriculture class. So there was an Ag 1 class, Ag 2, and so on. And then it got more specific after that. And one of the clubs or activities, extracurricular activities that you could do is something called FFA. It used to stand for Future Farmers of America, and now it just is National FFA because it's much more than just farming now. And I am one of those people. So I got into FFA, and I started doing some competitions, competing in stuff like agricultural sales, agricultural marketing, went to nationals for those. And I fell in love with wanting to help farmers feed the world and with agriculture. And so when I was choosing a major, I chose the major agricultural economics as an undergraduate. And what that is it's basically a business degree with an ag emphasis. And it's one of the most employable degrees in my area. I still am located in North Dakota. And one of the most employable degrees in, I'd venture to say, the Midwest. And so when I decided to do agricultural economics, I was introduced through my father. My dad is my hero, and he comes from a farm background. So does my mom. And they both farmed for a number of years. And now their brother's farm, and now my cousin's farm. And so I was around farming my whole life. I even bottle-fed calves when I was little. It's a fun little activity for younger kids to do.
And I guess it's also a rite of passage, really.
Yeah. I would say so. It's a lot of fun to see them, I guess to see him grow and flourish at a young age. So I grew up around farming, and my parents were involved in farming for a number of years. Then my dad decided to start a business for crop marketing and crop insurance. Crop marketing, he offers crop marketing advice, which basically is advice on when farmers should sell their grain or hedge their grain on a futures market. The futures market is commodity exchange platform, which also includes gold, silver. You can buy contracts for that. And the futures market, it's called the futures market because it's predicting what the price will be for those commodities in the future. And farmers either can buy or sell on the futures market to cover what they think the price will be come the fall time, come harvest. And so because the crop is growing in the field, it's a way for them to manage their risk. So that is more volatile than even the stock market. So crop marketing advice is, I wouldn't say a popular thing, but very well utilized by a lot of farmers in the area. And my dad thought he could do it better, bring more farmer-to-farmer contact. So my dad started that business, and then he started crop insurance along with it. And crop insurance is something that I am now licensed in and I sell. I got licensed when I was 18, started selling when I was 20. And I got to grow up looking at my dad as a crop insurance agent, being able to travel wherever he wanted, working from anywhere and helping farmers. And as I was going through high school, bringing it back to FFA, I found that I wanted to do that. I wanted to have the flexibility he had, but I wanted to help farmers. And I liked agriculture. So I decided to go into agricultural economics and decided to get licensed as a crop insurance agent when I was 18. Partially because my dad was a hero, but my dad had, you know, other than that, very little influence in me deciding to become a crop insurance agent. And then I started selling when I was 20. And crop insurance is very different from other insurances that you would sell. Most of the reason being that every product is the same. It's subsidized through the federal government, so every crop insurance company sells the same product, multi-peril crop insurance, and it's federally subsidized in some years, at least in the years that farmers have claims. And so they charge the same price. So the only difference in my in me versus someone else as a crop insurance is my service. And so you have to figure out how to provide better service than the other person. And because crop insurance is subsidized and because the peril is so large in farming, they're relying on a source that is the most unreliable source in the world, weather.
Yeah.
And that's part of their livelihood. And so crop insurance is a very important part, and that leads to I'd say 95 to 97% of farmers already buy crop insurance. So it's not new lead generation. It's not new lead creation. It's actually, I am always selling to someone who has another crop insurance agent. And so
we'll get to the point of you entering law school here in a minute, but I just want to touch base on a couple of things that you said before we lose sight of them, if I may. One, you know, I'm going to share my own ignorance with you and with the audience. You know, I'm a city boy. I grew up in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. And I think for most of our listeners who are in the same situation, we have this romanticized view of what being a farmer is or what running an agricultural business is. And it's a far cry from what you just described. I mean, the business around producing agricultural products is enormous. And we kind of oftentimes think it's just mom and pop, you know, plowing a few acres, you know, and fixing breakfast in the morning and hoping that that a tornado doesn't come through. You know, that's about the level of sophistication of most, I'm going to say most Americans, and certainly most lawyers path towards farming. So what you describe is really eye-opening to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and certainly all of that stuff happens. Trust me, they do eat breakfast together, but it's at 5 a.m. or you know, even 4:45. You know, sleeping in is sleeping to 6:30. You know, farmers don't mind going to a meeting at 7 in the morning.
It's very much different. And the other thing that strikes me is, and I'll get on my soapbox just for a second, but, you know, we as attorneys around the country, we moan and groan and whine about the competition and how hard it is to compete with the big boys, or, you know, how hard it is to succeed in the face of competition from established firms and the like. And I'm sitting here listening to you say, well, you think you got it tough competing? I got to compete with other crop insurance agents who sell the exact same product for the exact same price. So the only way I can differentiate myself is customer service.
Yeah, and really it is. I'm not saying that there's not a ton of challenges when it comes to being an attorney, especially small solo. And I'm starting to, we'll get to the legal side of things, but I'm starting to realize that. But trust me, I have never gotten a prospective customer by a video. And I've gotten 4 for estate planning already. And I've only been in business as an attorney since September 2022.
Yeah, that's another thing I wanted to bring up. So let's go. So you're thriving as a crop insurance agent, and you've gone to undergrad to get this degree, which, again, just one other thing. You know, 9 out of 10 attorneys here on this podcast probably never heard of that major as an undergrad major. You know, and I think it's something that we should pay attention to. Because, you know, without folks like you, without degrees like the one that you got and businesses like the ones that you support, we'd all starve. If you had run, now my wife's got a beautiful garden, but it's not supporting the neighborhood, I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And gardening, this is something that I wanted to mention, so I'm glad you brought it up. Gardening is a very small scale, we'd say, like, you know, 0.0000001% of what farmers do. So, you know, if you go into your garden, you're like, oh, these aphids ate my tomatoes this year. It's like, yeah. And then you take that times 10,000, and that's the, you know, that's the perils that agriculture is dealing with. So I welcome people into the agricultural world, and most farmers would too. Farmers are, if you think about it this way, and this was the way that I've started to think about it now, is farmers' job, their job as farming is done by only 1% of the world population.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are aspects of their everyday life and of my everyday life that the vast majority of people don't even know exist, let alone know everything about.
Yeah, couldn't say that better myself. Well put. So let's get you into law school now. What mm-hmm. motivated you to make that leap?
So the reason I brought up crop insurance is because within crop insurance, and part of my differentiator between my competition, is that there is a farm succession plan built into crop insurance rules that are promulgated by the risk management agency, the government. And not many crop insurance agents know that it exists, let alone know how to use those tools. And that's my biggest differentiator. Now, it's still hard to sell that point, but that farm succession plan can make it so that the next generation can farm with less risk and a higher crop insurance guarantee, which won't mean much to people that don't understand crop insurance, but basically farm with less risk than even the previous generation did, even though the previous generation has all of the data, all of the, you know, all of the structure in place. And so it can create a smoother transition for the next gen. And
let
so that's
see if I can understand that logic then, because I think what I hear you say is that for the insurer, government subsidized insurance element mm-hmm. or entity, that they have a vested interest in making sure that there's a succession plan in place, because if not, it puts the product that they're insuring at risk. Is that a fair summary?
I'd say so. And of course, the government likes to talk out of both sides of their mouths, I think.
Well, yeah, that's why we're the government.
Right. So, but on this side, they even have a beginning farmer. They have beginning farmer benefits, to where a beginning farmer, someone who has farmed for less than 5 years, or a veteran farmer as well. Veteran farmer is 10 years, that they can even get a higher amount of subsidy for the first 5 years of farming. So yeah, so that, I mean, there's a lot of tools in there that can be used. And the, you know, the beginning farmer benefits, I say, are the low hanging fruit. So when I talk to a prospective customer, a farmer, and they say, oh, well, you know, blah, 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 I'm moving straight into my parents' operation. Well, if they move straight into their parents' operation or their uncle's operation, they don't get those benefits. And so I know that there's something that I can do right away there. And I call that the low hanging fruit. And it really is that. So, you know, now I'm figuring out how to differentiate from my competition in that way. So the farm transition is the bread and butter of even my crop insurance. And so what I realized is as I was selling, marketing, teaching, because part of my job is an educator. I am an educator first, for sure, and then leading into sales. And I think the best salespeople are educators. After that, I realized that those same people that I was interacting with in the farm transition part needed a farm transition outside of just crop insurance. And I realized that there wasn't enough. I won't say they don't exist, because they do. And I had a great mentor that was, but there isn't enough estate planners that understand the farm transition of an estate plan. They can, I say, you know, estate planning is drafting the documents. Farm transition planning is figuring out who's going to live where. How much does the retiring your parents need to live? And the three most important questions that I ask the next generation are, the first one, generation that would take over, I call them Gen 2, even if it's, you know, actually Gen 10, Gen 15 mm-hmm. in some farms. The three most important questions I ask Gen 2 are you interested in taking over the farm? You know, that's the first question, important, pretty straightforward. The second question is, when do you want to become the major decision maker in the operation? And that question catches a lot of Gen 2s by surprise. Because there's farmers that are still actively farming at 83, 85, 87 years old. And then their kids are 60-year-old hired hands.
Yeah.
So that farm transition is so important and so emotional for both parties, that in any way that I can make that smoother on crop insurance or on, you know, the estate planning, farm succession part, I want to. So there's that. And then the third question I ask is, what skills do you need, Gen 2, in order to successfully take over that operation? Because sometimes they're not learning those skills as much as they should be. And so those are the three questions that I ask. And those questions are purely on the farm succession side. So part of farm succession is preserving farming assets and understanding that you know, a lot of estate planning attorneys that are involved in the agricultural world around my area will say fair isn't equal and equal isn't fair. And that's true, but it's this oversimplified, catchy way to say it. But it's really what I'm trying to do is make sure the next generation of farmers are successful. So it's that transfer of wisdom. It's not just transfer of assets. And, you know, wisdom I would consider an asset and probably the most important one.
It's interesting that when I listen to the questions you're asking prospective clients, and let's just kind of fill in the gap.
So you ended up going, when did you enter law school?
Right. So I entered law school in fall of 2019. I went to Drake University, and Drake is one of the well-known agricultural law schools in the country and the closest one to home. So I could, you know, continue to do my crop insurance. And I also happened to have a boyfriend that is now my husband back home in North Dakota. So I also wanted to be close for him. And I went into Drake hoping that I would learn something about agricultural law, but I actually learned more about just regular business law and estate planning. I think there are probably other colleges that would be better suited for agricultural law, but something that I would recommend, if there's any law students that listen to your podcast or any lawyers that are mentoring law students, I would recommend that a law students get an undergrad degree in something that they are passionate about and that they might want to use law for. So my undergrad degree was agricultural economics. So I didn't need to pigeonhole myself into some sort of ag degree in law school because I wanted to go into ag law.
Right.
I came in with that expertise and I had plenty of it. So I could actually just pursue what I wanted to do as far as estate planning, learning a little bit about merger law, learning a little bit about business law. And then I could come out with the skills that I need to start my business right away. Now, I also came in with skills that your podcast partially helps, you know, fill in those gaps of sales and marketing and how to run just a business, being a law entrepreneur. And I had that coming into law school, whereas your podcast is so valuable for so many lawyers that want to go, you know, solo or small business, that you know, we all know that law school usually does not prepare you to own your own business.
Right. Well, the thing that I was going to say that I thought was interesting is the three questions that you ask prospective clients, you know, from an estate planning perspective are, you know, perfectly applicable to anybody who owns a business. I would say the difference is, and I deal with that a lot, but in the suburbs and in the cities, a business can largely be contained exclusively in your wallet, so to speak, and on your computer. It, you know, the assets aren't as tangible as what you're dealing with. And so when you're talking about hundreds of acres and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of farming equipment and leases that you're managing, you know, for other, you know, people who are leasing farmland, it's a very complex business. And so you have to be able to step outside of just the ag world about how to maximize crops and your return on the crops. You really have to step out and say, from a business perspective, how are we going to transition? How are we going to have a succession plan that accounts for all these really expensive, tangible things?
And yeah, I was going to, if any of your listeners out there, or if you, Neil, have ever estate planned and done business succession planning for a larger, for a family business, but a larger construction, family-owned construction company. That would be the closest, right? And even that construction company, they have large amount of assets of, of equipment, construction equipment. And that's the same in farming. But in farming, you have the largest asset and the most important asset is land.
Sure.
And land, the only way that you really quote unquote profit off of land, other than, you know, growing the crops on the land, is by selling it. But no farmer sells their land.
Support for today's episode comes from Ruby, the number one client communication solution for growing legal practices. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, Ruby creates exceptional experiences for your callers and website visitors. They take messages, screen and transfer callers, schedule appointments, perform new client intake, confirm details with outbound calls, and can answer in English and Spanish, and a whole lot more. Just like an in-house receptionist, only better, because they turn every ring into a relationship.
Ruby can work full-time, part-time, or as a backup, and you can change your instructions anytime with their top-rated mobile app and online dashboard. Plus, Ruby integrates with tools such as Clio, Lexiclara, MyCase, and Rocket Matter. It all adds up to more opportunities and more time saved. In fact, 90% of legal professionals who use Ruby capture more billable hours than the national average, with many recording double or more. That's 5 or more billable hours per day. To experience the Ruby difference for yourself, visit get.ruby.com/ELE. That's get.ruby.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur, for up to $150 off your first month. Imagine you, powered by Ruby. And that's going to be my next question to you. Tell me a little bit about this whole concept of leasing farmland and how that works.
Mm-hmm. So I'll give a couple different examples, but leasing farmland is similar to other leases, except obviously it's per acre. So you figure out the acre. It's you and most people that are leasing farmland, or farmers that are leasing farmland for someone else. The farmers know exactly the type of land that they're dealing with. So the soil type changes how much you are fertilizing, or, you know, what crops you can grow on there. And I happen to be in the Red River Valley, where we grow sugar beets. And sugar beets are what is made into the domestic sugar that you know in the United States. And it's pretty well protected. So most of the sugar that you'd be buying in the stores is based on sugar beets that are grown mostly in the Red River Valley. And they're very productive. They're these big tuber looking things. Mm-hmm. They look kind of like a radish, but a lot bigger.
Yeah.
And they produce basically the whole U.S. domestic sugar supply. And it's right here in the valley. And sugar beet land is valued, even the lease and the actual price, if you were to purchase it, is valued at 2 to 3 times what land that you could grow wheat or soybeans or corn on. And there's also dry beans in our area. So lentils that, you know, that you'd use in chili and stuff like that, also grown in my area. And flax, if you put flax in your oatmeal or in your yogurt in the morning, also grown around this area. And flax is basically only grown in the very northern part of the U.S. So that would be North Dakota, Minnesota, and parts of Montana. And it's basically not grown anywhere else. And I mean, in small aspects it is, but so you have to take what crops can actually be grown on the field, which in part goes to soil type. And you have to figure out whether it's drain tiled or not, or whether it's able to be drain tiled. So drain tile is what goes underneath. And basically, instead of it flooding in the field, it can actually drain and go through drains and actually create more of a water stream and less flooding for even the township. So drain tile is really important, not only for the farmer, but for the area where the farm
community
is.
Community at large, yeah.
Right, exactly. And because of federal rules like Waters of the U.S., WOTUS for short, there's some pretty strict regulations that don't really make sense when it applied to farming. But, you know, the other attorneys are working on that. I don't need to cover that here. So there are all of these different aspects. And the person who is going to know the best for what the land should be leased for is the farmer that wants to lease the land. Which is pretty much the case for, you know, just a regular house buying or something like that.
Sure.
You usually lease payments come in 2 times a year. So at planting, at harvest. And part of that reason is operating loans usually get lent out at planting and usually lent out at harvest. Oh, so just from a cash flow perspective, it's usually around that time. And then you think about the planting season being anywhere, you know, from March, April, May, June, depending on what you're planting and where you're planting it, then that lease agreement would start a month before planting or something and maybe decided in December and, you know, so that you know where you're planting and stuff like that.
Is it typical to have a multi-year lease?
Yes, very typical, especially when we're dealing with family business or we're dealing with long-standing relationships. Now, here's where the interesting and very emotional part comes in.
Because I would think that would have a very definite effect on succession planning and the estate planning for, you know, the generation one farmers. We've got an asset that's a long-term existing lease.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. The longer term lease, the better. But the longer term lease, and you would understand this from a market perspective, the longer a lease is, the more that one party is probably not getting its fair shake.
So if
a lease is formula based, that's great. But you have to know how to actually draft that formula. So I have a lease agreement that I use in my estate planning that includes a first right to renew. And that first right to renew is a right for the tenant to renew at, you know, some negotiated price or at some formula. So when I'm doing farm succession planning and one piece of land is going to a non-farming sibling, we make the non-farming sibling sign that agreement saying that they will give their farming sibling the first right to renew their lease, and we'll even put a formula in there. And it will be as fair of a formula as we can draft, and it will be for a period of however long we think that generation two farming sibling can build up enough capital to either pay out the non-farming sibling or long enough for them to be able to develop that relationship and keep it going even after that that lease term expires. So there's a first right to renew, which is one of the most valuable things that I could put in there for both parties, because I'm obviously pro keeping the farm going. That's part of my mission statement is making sure that the farm can continue, and it's to make sure the family can continue. That's my whole mission statement in simple terms. And so the more that I can draft in a close enough formula that can stand the tests of time as much as I can, while keeping the farming sibling and non-farming sibling in mind. So the non-farming sibling gets a regular paycheck year after year for the lease agreement for that land that they were gifted. And so that is, you know, a wonderful blessing to them, and be a blessing to the farming sibling to be able to keep farming so that they can pay the non-farming sibling. And so when you consider all of that, you know, the longevity of the family farm continuing to exist while, you know, not infringing on, or I guess prohibiting the farming sibling from doing what they need to do in order to continue the farm as well. And that's usually I'm regurgitating the goals of the clients that I see. And so when there's farming and non-farming siblings, we get into those lease agreements and stuff like that. But where it gets really emotional is when I have a crop insurance customer, actually, that's going through the farm transition. He happened to go to law school and is a licensed attorney as well. He just doesn't practice, which is also an interesting subset of people that went to my law school. They came from farms, were farmers, are going back to farm and just doing a little bit of legal work on the side.
Yeah. Well, so I'm going to ask you about that legal work now too, because you hinted at it earlier. So you have your own practice now, and you're still doing the crop insurance and dealing with succession planning in that regard. But now you've added estate planning because it was a natural growth. Mm-hmm. And the marketing those two functions are different, are they not?
Oh, yeah, I would say so.
So well, how do you know about marketing your law practice and while maintaining your crop insurance business as well?
Mm-hmm. The good news about crop insurance is it's very seasonal. The busy times for crop insurance are basically when farmers are not busy is when the busy times for crop insurance would be. And so I've been able to be very flexible, and that is right. And that is partially why it's very attractive for me to be a small firm or a solo firm, because I am not working in estate planning every day. It's probably, you know, in the busy seasons of crop insurance, it's 1 or 2 days a week. And
so it sounds to me like for the crop insurance, you're sitting across the kitchen table talking to the prospective client. And for your estate planning, you may end up there, but you're starting from a different perspective. I think you mentioned that you're doing some videos now.
So, and that's part of my dad's business. It's called Progressive Ag, and I am actually moving into a management position at Progressive Ag. It's a crop insurance agency and crop marketing firm. And they host farmer meetings in January and February that give an update on what we should look at for marketing your crop for the year, how to manage your risk and that sort of stuff. So a crop marketing update. And that's the sexy thing that is always changing that people actually want to go to. And so that's a reason to bring them in. And then we also give an update on crop insurance, and we actually do a little bit of selling as to the farm transition part of things. Mm-hmm. And so that hopefully gets people interested, or at least gets people to the meeting. So then our respective agents, you know, our respective agents will host a meeting or two, and an agent will talk a little bit about it, and then they'll be able to follow up with everyone that's able to come. And it's a really, it seems to be a really good way to market and to find prospective customers. And then we added on estate planning this last year, and I gave a presentation. And so it's a seminar, just like if you have a financial planner that says, hey, I want you to come in and talk about estate planning.
Yeah.
So I gave that presentation at these farmer meetings all January and February. And so it's actually a similar way. That part is similar, but it's much easier to get an estate planning prospective client versus a prospective customer on crop insurance. It can take years to actually get someone that's willing to sit down and give a presentation on the crop insurance side.
I'm trying to imagine all those meetings in January and February in North Dakota.
Yeah,
hearty souls going out for those meetings, I'm telling you.
Absolutely. Actually, the best turnout for meetings is when it's, you know, negative 20 or negative 30 or worse, because they can't tinker around, or I shouldn't say tinker. They can't fix equipment. They can't get ready for spring in any other way. They'll even send some of their hired hands home. So they're able to actually give some time to come to a meeting.
That's interesting. Let's wrap up and have you tell us, what's the wackiest thing you deal with?
Okay.
Because it all sounds really complex, like you've got a great handle on it, by the way, Shelby. I mean, you're just a tremendous spokesperson for what you're doing and the community that you support. But there's got to be estate planning is full of wacky stories. And I'm just wondering if there's one that's kind of unique to the farming community, or something that you see that maybe other estate planners or other attorneys, business law attorneys, might not say.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's probably something that other attorneys would see, but it connects back to the land and how valuable land is. So a typical successful farm will rent 2/3 of their land and own 1/3. And
really?
Yep. Yeah. And if they can get to 2/3 ownership or even owning all of the land that they do. If they own all the land that they do, then I'd ask them if they if they have a growth mindset, or are they settling, or, you know, something like that. But most farms in my area, at least, 1/3 ownership, 2/3 renting. So a lot of farmers have relationships sometimes with very distant landlords. Or the transition when one landlord dies and it goes to, you know, distant, I guess, cousins collectively owning that. And that is a very emotional situation for the farmer leasing that land, because they, created this really good relationship with the owner of the land, and then the owner dies and their son or daughter or nieces or nephews that now own the land know absolutely nothing about farming.
Some knucklehead like me out in the nation's capital.
Right. And not saying that you're a knucklehead, but you know, not knowing anything about farming. So they know that farmland in the last year has increased probably 30% and has increased another 30%. So 60% in 2 years or more. And it might even have doubled and tripled from the amount that is currently being shown on property tax statements. And bankers know that. Farmland real estate owners know that, but that doesn't mean that the lease agreement is any higher, because the lease is just the productivity of the land. And even though land is inflated, doesn't mean that the productivity is any different.
Right.
And so it creates this huge dichotomy between, you know, what's a fair lease dollar amount versus, you know, what's actually on the land. So this isn't a wacky story, but it's a very emotional time, to the point where some farmers now are trying to figure out, they are actually discussing, when is it appropriate to put an offer in to buy the farm after someone dies?
Is it at the funeral?
You know?
Yeah, because the city slicker like me, who now owns 100,000 acres, is looking at the bottom line saying, wow, it's really increased in value. The way for me to get my money is to sell it. And then they're looking at the lease and saying, I'm only getting this amount of money on the lease because its productivity is, you know, only at this level. And so that creates a lot of tension. I can see that. And then the person working the farm is like, well, I want to buy it. How do I get enough capital to buy it and deal with the emotional aspect of it?
Right. Yeah. And again, land is the most valuable resource. And so it's actually easier to estate plan for a farmer that has someone to take over the farm for the next generation, because every farmer wants, I shouldn't say every, most farmers want to leave a legacy, and their whole legacy, I mean, it is a livelihood. It's not just a job for them. It's a full career, and it's so rewarding for so many people, and it's so challenging.
It's tied to that land.
Yes. So closely tied to that land.
Very much.
And so there's a few different aspects, I'll cover a little bit of each one. But I had one estate planning client came in to me and said, I don't want my boys having to pay lease agreements to me for my entire life that I'm still alive. I want them to get that land sooner rather than later, because I paid in lease payments probably twice over for all of the land that I now own.
Now that I now own
or that I rent, that I still rent, and he's paid two times over in lease payments.
Yeah.
Or rental payments. So there's that aspect of things. And then there's the aspect of, you know, the farmer that does not have someone to leave it to. I have a crop insurance customer that has already warned me that what he wants with his estate plan is very different. And here's what I think is the case. I think he wants to create a foundation so that some farmer is always farming that land. But he wants basically control for the rest of eternity. So that's a wacky thing, but it's from this emotional legacy part of things. So that would I get the feeling of that from multiple people that don't have someone to leave it to, is they still want to leave a legacy and a long lasting one. And then we run into rule of perpetuities, which we never see anywhere else.
Anywhere else, but in land deals. All right.
Yeah. So just that emotion around land that has to do with the wackiest things that I said. And then I have to reel him back and say, hey, do you know how much this is going to cost you if you want to do something like this? Yeah.
Well, listen, I'm hopeful. We have a lot of listeners that aren't on either coast. They're in between, and what some people mistakenly referred to as Flyover America. But I spent a lot of my formative years in Wyoming and Colorado, so I have a bit of a sense of how important that part of our country is and of what great people there are in that part of the country. I hope this has opened some eyes and that folks who are in the Midwest and the West can relate to what you've gone through and what you are creating there in North Dakota. So if they want to reach out to you and connect with you, what's the best way for them to follow up after this?
Definitely LinkedIn. And as a, you know, currently solo law entrepreneur, I'm not even sure what you would call that.
Solo practitioner.
Okay, thank you. Solo practitioner. I'm so inexperienced that I didn't even know the lingo for it. So I would love to have mentors out there. You know, I fully understand the farm transition and I can learn and have learned most of the estate planning side of things, but just stuff like, what do I even need to look for to go through a probate? Something really simple like that, and just having a network of relationships around. Please connect with me on LinkedIn, or if you want more information about going to law school or about my unusual journey and my unusual journey afterwards, and to bring it back to the whole reason that I went into agriculture. If you want to get into agricultural law or agriculture in general, you will not regret it. The people that you meet, farmers and ranchers and agriculturalists, are some of the nicest, most honest, hardworking folks that you'll ever meet. And they're certainly the good and bad in every, I guess, group,
yeah.
In every community.
Yeah.
Yeah. But man, these yes. Yeah.
Salt of the earth type of folks.
Yes, these are the cream of the crop, to use an ag reference euphemism, and all I want to do is help farmers feed the world, and it is turned into a very rich experience, and part of the allure to go with someone like me is they can see my passion, and regardless of what your passion is, people will see that, and man, don't ever, I'd say if you want to get into agriculture, make sure you understand who you're going toe-to-toe with, because the people that come to my office, they don't look like much, but they are worth multi-million dollars. They wear all of these different kinds of hats. They are some of the most sophisticated business people that I've ever met. And people, I think farmers are hugely misrepresented. It still is a mom and pop and still is a family operation. And they still, you know, take their kids, they run calves, they're doing all of that stuff. They ride horse sometimes, most of the time it's ATV, but just understanding the conglomerate of a family farm nowadays is quite incredible. And I feel so humbled to be able to go toe to toe with those people.
Well, it's been fascinating to share some time with you, Shelby, and I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today on The Law Entrepreneur, and I wish you all the best.
I wish you the best too. Thanks, Neil.
Well, there you have it, boys and girls, another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode, our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them, and I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO, as I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client. And then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity
for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneurs.